WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. We were saddened this week to learn of the death of spoken word artist Sekou Sundiata. He died Wednesday of heart failure at the age of 58. His work included poetry, music, and dance, and came out of a tradition that runs from Langston Hughes to Chuck D of Public Enemy. Bill Moyers, who included Sundiata on his PBS poetry series, said of him, "His music comes from many places. If we could trace their common origin, we'd arrive at the headwaters of the soul." On today's Fresh Air, we listen back to several of our interviews with him. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Hairspray. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. On Wednesday, America lost a unique artist whose work defies easy description. Sekou Sundiata's work often blended poetry, dance, music, and even video, exploring themes of slavery, exploitation, and national identity in the black experience in America. Sundiata died of heart failure in Valhalla, New York. He was 58. His work, which premiered last year, called The 51st Dream State, deals with American life in a post-9/11 world. Among his other works are Udu, about slavery in Mauritania, Blessing the Boats, a one-man show about his experiences with heroin addiction, a debilitating car crash, and a kidney transplant, and The Circle Unbroken is a hard bop, about black Americans coming of age in the 1960s. Sundiata taught writing at New York's New School University. He released several CDs of music and poetry, including The Blue Oneness of Dreams, which earned a Grammy nomination. Today we'll listen to parts of Sekou Sundiata's three appearances on Fresh Air. First, from his 1997 conversation with Terry, here's Sundiata introducing his poem, Shout Out.
I mean, if I had to describe, you know, a qualifying thing for me as a poet, you know, people say, well, you're a performance poet or whatever. That's not really how I identify myself. I think of myself, if anything, as a ritual poet, meaning that I think of poetry as ritual. I think that that is the roots of it, you know, the roots of it in chanting and dance, et cetera, et cetera. So I was really thinking about trying to create a poem that would have a ritual feel to it in the sense of being an opening, an introduction to what is to follow, whether it's, you know, more poems or the set with the band. This is typically how I open a set when I perform with my band, the body of the poem. I'll just also say that, you know, Shout Out is a tradition on radio, particularly on black radio, where basically people call up the radio station and give shout outs. You know, they a shout out to, you know, my cousin, a shout out to my girlfriend, a shout out to whoever, you know, and it really is just a dedication. I always loved that because it was just a chance for, you know, everyday folk to get access to this mass media, to the airwaves, and make a dedication. So here it is, Shout Out. Here's to the best words in the right place at the perfect time. Here's to three-hour dinners and long conversations, to the philosophical ramifications of a beautiful day. To the 12-steppers at the 13th step, may they never forget the first step. To the increase, to the decrease, to the do, to the did, to the do, to the did, to the do, to the did, to the done-done. To the lonely, to the broken-hearted, to the new blue haiku. Here's to all or nothing at all. Here's to the sick and the shut-in. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to the crazy, the lazy, the bored, the ignored, the beginners, the sinners, the losers, the winners, to the smooth and the cool, and even to the fools. Here's to your ex-best friend, to the rule benders and the repeat offenders, to the lovers and the troublers, the engaging, the enraging, to the healers and the feelers and the fixers and the tricksters, to a star falling through a dream, to a dream when you know what it means, to the bottom, to the root, to the base, boom, to the drum. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to somebody within the sound of your voice this morning. Here's to somebody who can't be within the sound of your voice tonight. To a low cholesterol pig sandwich smothered in sign without the pork. To a light buzz in your head and a soundtrack in your mind going on and on and on and on like a good time. Here's to promises that break by themselves. Here's to the breaks with great promise. Here's to people who don't wait in the car when you tell them to wait in the car. Here's to what you forgot and who you forgot. Here's to the unforgettable. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found. Here's to the hip-hoppers, the don't-stoppers, heads nodding in the digital glow of their beloved studios. To the incredible, indelible impressions made by the gazes you gaze in the faces of strangers. To yourself you ask, could this be God straight up, or is it a mask? Here's to the tribe of the hyper-cyber, tripping at the virtual most outpost, at the edge, on the tip, believing that what they hear is the mothership. Drawing near. To the was you been, to the is you in, to was deep and deep, to was down and down, to the lost and the blind and the almost found.
I love hearing you read that. You're a poet who uses your voice in, I think, a particularly musical way. And I wonder if you were always reading that way or if you had to find your voice.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the way I present my work has evolved over time. You know, and I've thought about it. You know, in the beginning, it wasn't very conscious, really a very conscious development. But as I thought about it over time, I really set about trying to develop a sound and approach that I thought was uniquely mine. I should also say that, you know, in the way that I started writing poetry and got into poetry, I really felt that I was trying to ground myself, first and foremost, in African-American culture. And so my first love in African-American culture was Black speech and Black music. And really, I think to understand something about Black speech and Black music, you know, helps anyone understand what's going on in Black literature, whether it's fiction, poetry, playwriting, whatever. So for me, it has always been a question of the musicality of language, the musicality of Black speech. So by the time I started writing and reading my poetry, I was really started being interested in developing a sound that was mine, much in the way that, you know, jazz musicians. Music to me has always been a reference point and a resource, you know. In jazz, you know, certain things are given. By the time a musician gets on the bandstand, technique is a given, harmony is a given, that you've mastered your instrument is all given. You know, the thing that has to be revealed yet is how you sound, which is to say, what do you have to say? What is your particular take on your instrument and your take on the world? So that you may have two tenor saxophone players, both playing body and soul, for example, but each of them having something fresh and different to say. And, you know, I kind of use that as a model as I, over time, have developed my way of reading and presenting my poetry.
We're listening to interviews from our archives with the poet Sekou Sundiata, who died Wednesday at the age of 58. He was first on Fresh Air in 1994 in connection with his theater piece, The Mystery of Love. Here's an excerpt.
Somebody much wiser, somebody much wiser than you or I once said that the truth will not be told by the battles you win or lose, but by the stories we believe in. Whoever said there was a light at the end of the tunnel was a liar. The darkness begins, the blackness takes us back. In between are the stories, the light and the precious light. I got a story, you got a story. My man Max, my man Shine, and my girl Sissy got a hell of a story. This is the house and the home of hearsay. The poetic truth of all the available facts, otherwise known as the crossroads, from sea to can't see, from talk to song, from drum to tongue. The events here described take place in the wilderness of North America, and the names have not been changed to protect nobody.
In Mystery of Love, you say the truth cannot be told by the battles you win or lose, but by the stories we believe in.
Hmm.
You believe that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the battles tell one aspect of the truth, you know, maybe in a more factual kind of way. But I think once we understand what kinds of belief systems and values people carry around, you know, we get to a more central kind of truth.
So what were there certain stories you grew up on, like either family stories or stories about the neighborhood or?
Yeah, I mean, stories I grew up on, but as you say that right now, there's another story that I'm much more interested in that I'd really like to tell you.
Yeah, please.
My family just started having family reunions in the last 4 or 5 years, and both sides of my family are based in South Carolina. And so I went to a family reunion in Charleston, South Carolina. My mother, who lives there, lives about 70 miles inland from Charleston. So this was the day of the family banquet. So we were all gathered, you know, and the food was there, et cetera. And I was asked to speak and to do a poem at the family reunion, you know. And I was supposed to talk about the importance of family. That was my assignment, you know. And so, I went to pick my mother up, and we're all in the car, my mother, her sister, a couple of kids, and we're driving back to Charleston for the banquet. And we just happened to be riding in 2-lane highway, And my mother and her sister kind of joking, talking about the family, and said, well, you know, you never know who's related to who, because from here right out to the coast, out to Charleston, were all these plantations. And they often sold, you know, slaves from one plantation to the other. So, and kind of laughing and saying, you know, we might have cousins stretching from here straight out to, you know, out to Charleston, you know. And then they mentioned somebody named John, Papa John, who I never heard of before, you know. This turns out to be my great-great-grandfather. And they were really talking about him, saying that he may have had children wherever he went. And I said, well, why did he, you know, go so many places? They said they kept selling him because he was a rebellious slave. And so they would sell him from one, you know, one plantation to another. And I asked what happened to him. And they said that he was lynched, you know. And then they said, well, my mother and my sister telling me this, and her sister telling me this story. My mother says he was lynched. And then her sister says, yeah. And when they lynched him, they asked him if he wanted to say anything before they lynched him. And my mother started laughing, and she said, yeah. He said, hand me my mirror so I can see my hair, right, to make sure he looked good, you know. This was an amazing story, you know, and that they had this story all these years, you know. And apparently what happened is they lynched him. They knew the area. They grew up right down the road from where he was lynched, and they said that as children, little girls, they would be afraid to be down the road when sundown came, because they thought the ghost of Papa John would come up to get them. Well, what happened is they lynched him and did a poor job. I didn't know you could do a poor job in a lynching. Did a poor job, apparently, and left him for dead. He wasn't dead. He made his way back to the black community, and some people turned him in, and they came back and finished the job. You know, and the choice there was, that was really a sacrifice. Because the choice was, well, you know, either that or they come, you know, the Klan come, they come back, and no telling what happens then. You know, everybody begins to pay the price for that. So that was really a sacrifice, just to give an idea of what the raw terror was, you know, at that time. And so I had this story, you know, this, and that they knew since they were little girls, and these women are now in their 70s, you know. And what happened is the occasion of the family reunion allowed this story to surface. So when we got to the family reunion, it was my turn to talk, you know. And I told you I'd be interested in this rites of passage stuff. And there were all these young people in the family I'd never seen before, you know. I said, well, you know, I have a new hero. I discovered a hero on my way to the banquet. And I told this story about Papa John, you know. And several of the younger kids came up later and asked me all sorts of questions about it, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know where that's going, but somehow or another, not only is it a personal family story, but it has all these mythic possibilities to me.
Did you say to your mother, how come you never told me this?
I did,
before?
Yeah, I did. And they, it just somehow or another, it just never occurred to them, you know, that this story would be so valuable, you know. And even then they weren't really telling it because they figured I needed to know. It just happened to surface. The other thing I recognize about aging and maturing and getting older is, you know, they say that every story has its time to be told. And what I realize now is dealing with my mother and her peers, you know, is you don't have to ask them almost for these stories. If you're just around them, they start to surface. It's almost as if they want to give these stories up. They want to pass them on. I get kind of mystical about it. You know, there's something inside just saying that now it's time to tell this story. So it wasn't only that story since then. It's been many, many other stories that as a young boy, I just never heard, you know, but are very valuable.
Poet Sekou Sundiata speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. Sundiata died on Wednesday. He was 58. We'll continue our remembrance of Sekou Sundiata after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering poet Sekou Sundiata, who died earlier this week at the age of 58. Let's continue with more from Terry's 1997 interview.
Let me play something from the new CD that has music behind you, and I consider this poem to be one of like your greatest hits. You've you've also done a video of this poem that our listeners might have seen on MTV. This is called Blink Your Eyes, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about how you're using the music behind you, how you work this out.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of things going on in this particular version of it. One is that I wrote the poem really sort of, you know, responding to this well-documented and well-known antagonistic relationship between black and Latino males in particular and the police. So that was one part of it in terms of subject matter. The other part of it was, you know, I teach, and I started getting a number of students a few years back who were coming in to write poetry who were really influenced by hip-hop and really wanted to write in a way that was very different from what I knew and from the way I sort of came up or developed as a writer. And so they really, you know, I guess my reference point for a lot of people I came through with was jazz. People who wrote and tried to use jazz as a reference point. For them, it was hip-hop. So, you know, I tried to write this poem as sort of a dedication to them. Then the other part is a dedication to Sterling Brown, who was many people called the Dean of Black Poetry, and who wrote, I guess, in, you know, particularly in a so-called folk idiom and in a blues idiom very much. Musically, I don't know. You know, we were sort of finding our way in the studio. We'd done this poem in a number of different ways, and we were really trying to find something fresh to make it sort of new and interesting to us. One of the things that happened is I made a sample and used a sample in this cut, and it's a sample of Sweet Honey in the Rock, singing a blues, Your Worries Ain't Like Mine, which I thought was fitting, given the subject matter of the piece. And then, of course, I thought it should have some sort of drive to it, some sort of driving pulse, some sort of driving beat. You know, so all of those ideas sort of came together to form what we have now.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is the poem Blink Your Eyes from Sekou Sundiata's new CD, The Blue Oneness of Dreams.
I was on my way to see my woman, but the law said I was on my way through a red light, red light, red light. And if you saw my woman, you could understand I was just being a man. Wasn't about no light, it was about my ride. And if you saw my ride, you could dig that too, you dig? Huh? Do you really dig? Sunroof, stereo, radio, radio, sunroof, stereo, radio. Black leather bucket seats sit low. You know the body's cool, but the ties are worn. Ride when the hard times come, ride when they're gone. In other words, Jack, the light was green. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change. Blink your eyes, blink your eyes. All depends on the skin, all depends on the skin you're living in. All depends on the skin, all depends on the skin you're living in. Up to the window come the law with his hand on his gun. What's up, what's happening? I said, I guess that's when I really broke the law. He said a routine. Step out the car. He set a routine. Assume the position. Hands up in the air. You know the routine. Like you just don't care. License and registration. Deep was the night and the light did it deep. In the deep was the night from the light from the north star on the car door. I could see deja vu. We've been through this before. Why did you stop me? Somebody, body, 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 body. Somebody had to stop you. I watched the news. You always lose. You're unreliable. That's undeniable. This is serious. You could be dangerous. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change. Blink your eyes. Blink your eyes. All depends on the skin. All depends on the skin you live in. All depends on the skin. All depends on the skin you live in. I could wake up in the morning without a warning, and my world could change.
People who are into rap really like rhyme. Do you think that that's made it safe to like poetry?
I think so. I think hip-hop, rap has really if there's any single thing I could point to that has led the way and opened the doors for this current revival and this interest in poetry, I think that's been it. If for no other reason, then it has prepared people to listen to the spoken word, and then again to the spoken word with music as well.
You know, there's a line in Harlem, A Letter Home, that I think so clearly shows the influence of song lyrics on your poems. When you're talking about being at the Apollo Theater and everybody wanting to be kissed the way they say. Why don't you do the line, because I'm just paraphrasing.
We used to be backstage at the Apollo waiting for the stars, begging them to kiss us like they say. You know, it's a funny thing about that is, I guess people project their own fantasies and dreams onto the lead singer in particular. Right. So, I always thought that, that this must be the way they kiss, the way they sing. It must be that beautiful, that compelling.
And now you think?
I it may be true.
Would you ever think when you're reading that people must project that onto you?
That's a power spot, to be in front of the band.
That's right.
To be the front man in a band, and you got the microphone and the spotlight, and, that is a mythic place, especially in American culture, So I think, it has probably less to do with me than the power of the position itself,
Sekou Sundiata speaking with Terry Gross in 1997. He died on Wednesday. We'll hear more of him in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. From Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to our 2002 interview with spoken word artist Sekou Sundiata, and he performs an excerpt of his theater piece Blessing the Boats about the year he had kidney failure, dialysis, and a kidney transplant. Blessing the Boats is about no longer being the self you thought yourself to be. And David Edelstein reviews Hairspray. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we're remembering Sekou Sundiata, a poet, performer, and one of the fathers of the spoken word movement. He died Wednesday of heart failure at the age of 58. When Terry spoke to Sundiata in 2002, he was performing a one-man show about the period when he had kidney failure, dialysis, and eventually a kidney transplant. In late 1999, after finally recovering from his transplant, Sundiata was traveling to what would have been his comeback performance. Driving through the snow in New England, his car slid off the road and he broke his neck. He spent the following year recovering from surgery. The show he wrote based on his illness took its title from a poem by Lucille Clifton, who also had a kidney transplant. The show was called Blessing the Boats.
Sekou Sundiata, welcome back to Fresh Air. Can you perform a short excerpt from your new piece?
Sure. This is from a section called The Part That Hurts. Here I am, a middle-aged brother with the shakes who can't stay awake, who has to hold on to the wall because his head is spinning like a gyroscope. A poet who can't make poems because there's too much distance between his mind and his body. And anyway, his mind is so slow and confused that ideas just bounce around and reverberate like a sound effect. Where's my witty? Where's my sovereignty? And most of all, where the hell is my cool? I was no longer the self I thought myself to be. How do you just wake up one day and not be who you think you are? I'll tell you how. The body is a low-down, dirty sneak. It remembers every physical or psychological insult it ever suffered. And each insult leaves a scar. And that scar is a map to the insult that just lays in the cut like a memorial. And should you delete it from your memory, your body will retrieve the data and bring it back up just when you're trying to go to sleep. Or just when somebody tells you that you're cute. Or just when you tell yourself how cool you are. Here comes the big payback. Your body will break you down. It will make you beg. It will make you change your priorities. For example, I was surprised to find out the size of the kidney. The kidney's job is to regulate a delicate balance of chemicals and minerals and water in the body. They clean the blood and regulate blood pressure. Big job, big organs. Simple as that. But most kidneys are the size of a small fist, and they're located in the back, off to the side. I had taken it for granted that the most important part of the body was located front and center. This is what I mean about the body being a sneak. It'll let you believe things like that until it's ready to tell you the truth. It ain't the heart, or the lungs, or the brain. The biggest, most important part of the body is the part that hurts.
That's Seiko Sundiata performing an excerpt of his new theater piece, Blessing the Boats. Seiko Sundiata, I really like this piece a lot. Why did you want to do a performance about your period of medical crisis?
Well, you know, first of all, in writing this piece, it is written in a way that is very different from the way I write. I don't write in a really personal way or an obviously autobiographical way. The first thing that drove me to write about this was my experience of going on dialysis and needing a transplant. I was on the transplant waiting list, which, you know, can be anywhere from 2 years to 5 years or more for some people. And during that period of time, five of my friends came forward and volunteered to be donors, to donate a kidney. And, you know, we went through the whole process of tissue typing and blood testing and all of that. And four out of the five people were found to be a match. It's very unusual, very rare, especially for people who are not related. And, you know, I was moved by that personally. And, you know, to me, it was a story that it just had so many implications to it in terms of what I call grace. The idea that for me, I couldn't have done anything to really earn anybody's kidney. Yet here were these people coming forward, volunteering to put their lives in jeopardy to save mine, essentially. So I was really driven by that this to me was just some unearned grace that is an always compelling story.
This is a very different kind of story for you in several ways. As you say, your things aren't often personal in that sense. And also, a lot of your stories are about somebody who's very mythic in a way, very cool or very revolutionary or very much about romantic love or risk-taking. You're writing sometimes about being African-American in America and what that means. And this is about being vulnerable.
Yeah, no question. The experience of having what's called end-stage renal disease and not knowing for quite some time, I'm talking about 3 years or more, 3-4 years, really what was wrong, you know, thinking that the symptoms sometimes can be some of anything. You know, there's a cluster of symptoms that can relate to a number of different things, and they're easy to excuse, especially if you're living a very busy and active life, which is what I was doing at the time. I felt by the time I was diagnosed with having renal failure, it was a new way of thinking about myself and a new way of thinking about my body. You know, I grew up being very active, being a amateur athlete, running, playing sports and all of those things. And all of a sudden, my body would not do what I wanted it to do, you know, when I wanted it to do it. So it was a whole new way of being vulnerable.
There are two ways of getting a new kidney if you have kidney disease. One is to get a kidney from somebody who has just died, who was an organ donor. And the other is to get the kidney from somebody who you know, who is willing to undergo surgery and donate one of their kidneys to you. You took that second route. Did you think you were initially going to go the other route of getting it from an anonymous organ donor?
Yeah, I was on the transplant list, and I was on the list for about a year and a half, and I had no intention of asking anyone for a kidney. That was another part of it. I just couldn't imagine asking someone to give me a kidney. In fact, the nurses who looked after me when I was on peritoneal dialysis told me that I was the first patient they had who never asked them for a kidney. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that somebody would just ask, especially essentially a stranger, for a kidney. So in my mind, it was settled that I would be on the list until I got that call saying that, you know, we have a kidney for you, come to the hospital. But a couple of my friends said just at first casually that, yeah, I would give you a kidney. And, you know, I kind of just said thank you at first. But, yeah, it was, they mentioned it more than one time and wanted to talk about it seriously and wanted to know what it would take. And then finally it sank in. And, you know, I realized that, you know, these people were serious and they would really go through with the testing. And if they were a match, would donate, you know, donate their kidney. And, you know, again, these are unrelated. These are friends. These are not blood relatives.
So who are the people who made the offer?
Well, one is the woman that I love. I call Kazi, and she appears in the piece. The others are friends. You know, just two people were friends of hers who became friends of mine. You know, the longer we knew each other, one person is a long term friend that I've known. Her name is Sydney. I've known her for about 25 years. The other two people were two men named Bill and Claude, and then my close friend and manager, Katia Stitt, turned out to be the one who was the match, and turned out to be my. Actually, they were all matches, but she turned out to be the donor.
Why her? Why not the other people?
Well, since four out of five people matched, and we had discussions about it. Basically, over dinner, we would go out and have these great.
For all of you, the whole group.
Yeah, we would call them transplant dinners. We have these great dinners with great food and, you know, wine and laughter and everything. And we would talk about the transplant. And finally, we all went to get tested together. And when the results came in, we had another meeting to talk about what to do since, you know, all these people matched. And basically, they ranked themselves. They decided that Kazi, who was the only one with a child, would be fourth, because she had a child, and there was some concern about that. Claude, who had some medical issues of his own going on, was ranked third. And then Bill, who was in good health and older than the rest, came in second. And Katia, who was in good health, the youngest, volunteered to be first. And then everyone else volunteered to be backup donors in case anything went wrong for any of us. You know, and to me, that was just remarkable. And whenever I would tell people the story, even before the transplant and after the transplant, whoever I tell that story to was really just moved by it. And so I thought that, you know, there's something in this story that is just beyond me. It's great, much, much greater than me. And it does speak to ideas about love and friendship, but also just about unearned grace.
I think it's interesting that your friends ranked themselves and took you out of the equation.
Yeah.
You know, no, that way the onus wasn't on you to decide, yeah, who gave up the kidney. That must have been a great relief to have that decision taken out of your hands.
Absolutely. I mean, even at one point, before we got to that point when we were having a dinner with, I think there were three of us together, we were talking about the transplant and someone being a donor, and I said, well, you know, I don't know if I really want to do that, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember Claude said, well, you know, it's really not up to you. You know, if it's meant for you to have this kidney and you have people here who are willing to give it to you, you're going to have this kidney, you know. So the whole time, you know, I felt I was, you know, of course, operating under my own steam and under my own will, but I also feel that there was something else at work there.
Katia, your manager, who donated your kidney, I'm just wondering if she was white or African-American.
African-American. African-American. And, I mean, it's interesting you would ask that because
I felt uncomfortable asking. Is that a bad question to ask?
No. I think it's a good question. And for a number of reasons. One is that, first of all, it gives me an opportunity to say what I'm about to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
And that is that, you know, I really did think, as I suspect many people who don't know anything about the world of transplantation, that transplants needed to be race, that it was better if they were race specific and gender specific. You know, in other words, I thought that, you know, that it would be a real difficulty for a black person to be a donor to a white person, and or for a man to a woman, or all of those things. And I guess those are ideas that I import from the social realm, you know. That's not the case. I mean, and I met adults my age or in and around my age who had what they call pediatric kidneys, you know, kidneys from really very young children, you know. So, you know, apparently that's not an issue preventing transplantation, although race does play a part in certain ways. When I was in those 3 weeks when I was in the hospital for the transplant, one of the difficulties I had is my body, my immune system was resisting being suppressed by the medication they gave me. And I was on the highest dosage of one of the immunosuppressant drugs, but my body was not absorbing it. And the doctor told me that African Americans have the hardest immune system to suppress, which I found interesting. In fact, I had something about that in one of the earlier versions of the script, you know. And to me, that was an interesting thing, just personally, but also in a historical, as a writer, I took a great interest in that, thinking about why that would be and how maybe, why did that evolve in that way? Why did African Americans evolve in that way? And what connections that may have had to the stress of slavery and Middle Passage and all of those things. So I think that is the question you ask is a valid and very worthwhile question. I think people thinking about donation have those questions.
Sekou Sundiata speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today we're remembering spoken word artist Sekou Sundiata, who died Wednesday. Here's more of his conversation with Terry in 2002.
You were preparing for a comeback concert in New England, and you were driving to this concert, you know, after you had gotten healthy enough following your kidney transplant to start performing again. You're driving in a snowstorm through New England to get to this comeback concert. And you were in a car accident and broke your neck in the car accident. And from my understanding, you nearly died in that accident. You were trapped in the car for a couple of hours. What was going through your mind when you were in that car with a broken neck after having just gotten through this horrible period of kidney failure, kidney transplant, post-kidney transplant surgeries, finally recover, and then you're in this horrible accident?
Well, my first thought, I mean, even as the car was sliding, you know, in the snow, was how absurd this was. You know, it just seemed stupid to me. First of all, this happened in January of 2000. I had my last surgery related to the transplant in December. I don't even know if it was a full month before the accident. So I was still in a sense recuperating from that. So I thought that was, you know, I was putting that behind me when this whole thing happened. And I remember thinking as the car was sliding off the highway that I just couldn't believe it could all come down to this. You know, it just seemed like such an absurd and silly thing, you know, to happen. And then also, I have to tell you this, you know, I think that there's no question that my life was in danger. I didn't know that my neck was broken while I was there, you know, upside down in the snow. And I didn't think anybody could see that I'd gone off the road. But I never felt that I was going to die. You know, I never felt that that was it. And I don't know, there's no physical evidence to support that idea because it was a blinding snowstorm. I dropped down a slope. You could not see me from the highway. And I couldn't even hear the car, the traffic on the highway passing by. So I had no real evidence to support that. It was just a blind faith that I had that somehow this was not it. At the same time, I'd never been so alone and isolated in my life. And I don't think I never knew things could be that quiet either. And then this woman shows up, kneeling beside the car in the storm, and she has a cell phone. And she starts talking to me, and she calls 911, and, you know, she gets all of that going. And by the time the fire department arrives, this woman is gone. I never see her again. I don't know her name or any of that, but she's just gone. And from at that point on, you know, the fire department has it, and they cut me out and all of that.
Did you have any idea before all this happened to you that people could be so good, so decent?
Yeah, I did. I did. You know, and really, it's a case of knowing something for quite some time, and then something happens and you get to know it at an even deeper and more profound level. I've been fortunate in my life to just been helped and assisted by so many people, both people I've seen and then people I haven't seen, but I know that, you know, people have helped me in various ways. And, you know, I've had just an example of many, many examples of this kind of goodness. Having said that, it didn't diminish in any way the fact that this was seemingly out of the blue, you know, and very mysterious. I mean, she showed up and then she was gone, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that that's fundamental in the human heart, you know. And I think it's probably more common than we may perceive on a day-to-day basis.
Seiko, would you be willing to perform another short excerpt from your show, Blessing the Boats?
Sure. This is a poem that comes early in the piece. And it is, every time I went into the operating room and I started going in, when I was under anesthesia, I'd always hear this music. I mean, really beautiful music. It wasn't the same music all the time, but it was just beautiful, rapturous music. And it was so beautiful and so present that whenever I came out of anesthesia, I was sure everybody else could hear it. So I'd ask, you know, the doctors and the nurses, and nobody ever heard this music. And in most cases, they would say they didn't even play music in the operating room at the time. So this comes out of that. This poem comes out of that experience. Somewhere deep and under anesthesia, the valves of a human heart open and close, and the black scat syllables of sacred science come pouring onto a clean page turning over in my mind. The blues bat their eyes and rustle their wings. A double reed vibrates in a pure light that means all things are possible. A bow draws out a round tone across the waist of a bass. It could be the devil's note, the way it cuts through the wood and wind, bending the sound right side up, harmonizing the underworld. Whoever said the music goes into the air and then it's gone was wrong. It goes below the flesh and above the grave, where I am flat as a mesa, open as the great gorge beneath the Taos sky. I try to remember the notes by humming, but humming burns the music out of memory.
Seiko Sundiata in 2002. He died Wednesday of heart failure. He was 58. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new film version of Hairspray. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. The musical Hairspray is set in the 60s and centers on Tracy Turnblad, a chubby Baltimore high school girl obsessed with a local teen dance program. When she lands a spot as a regular, she's amazed to find that blacks can appear only once a month and never with whites. The film, inspired by John Waters' comedy, stars John Travolta in drag as Tracy's mom, who's drawn into the cause to, quote, make every day Negro Day. David Edelstein has this review.
There's something about the journey of John Waters' Hairspray to its current incarnation as a candy-colored, big-budget family movie musical that I still can't quite believe. The 1988 comedy was inspired by the Buddy Dean Show, a Baltimore teen dance showcase of the early and mid-60s, and what turned Waters on was the fusion of rock and roll and outlandish middle-class tackiness, especially the high lacquered hairstyles that doubtless contributed to the erosion of the ozone layer. Waters was gleeful at having made a teen message movie with a PG rating. He was, after all, the Prince of Puke, the man who'd ended Pink Flamingos with his homicidal heroine eating a fresh doggy turd. Of course, it was a satire of teen message movies, with a 400-pound transvestite in the lead. But by the time of Hairspray, the ironic appreciation of kitsch had moved from gay subculture to the mainstream. And by the time Hairspray was turned into a Broadway musical 15 years later, busloads of 60-ish suburbanites were in on the joke. Now, Adam Shankman's movie of the Broadway Hairspray is getting rave reviews in newspapers that would once have applauded Waters' imprisonment. But I found it tacky in a different way than the original. It's fatuously energized. Every number is meant as a showstopper, with pumping arms, hyperactive editing, and climax on top of climax. The songs by Mark Shaiman all have the same manic pitch and blur together. The movie opens with hefty Tracy Turnblad, played by Nikki Blonsky, popping out of bed and bursting into a cheerfully oblivious celebration of her seedy Baltimore neighborhood. It's a crowd pleaser, and Blonsky's voice is sweet and not too piercing. But our heroine's delusional optimism has already peaked. How much higher can she soar? When the obese teenager lands a spot on the Corny Collins show and becomes a sensation, we seem to be in a world of village idiots. It was divine as Tracy's overprotective mother, Edna, who lifted Hairspray into camp heaven, and divine and her splendid trashy baggage, who's painfully missed. For most of the film, John Travolta is a glaring mistake. His face is ballooned with latex that hides that goofy cleft chin, his most endearing feature. With his studied Baltimore accent, he's soft and shapeless, his casting a stunt with no reason for being except as a stunt. His scenes with Blonsky and Christopher Walken as Edna's dim, doting husband are full of dead air.
No one is auditioning for anything in this household.
But why not? Why not?
Dancing is not your future. One day you're going to own Edna's Occidental Laundry.
I don't want to be a laundress. I want to be famous.
Well, if you want to be famous, learn how to take blood out of car upholstery. That's a skill you can take right to the bank.
Hey, hey. What's all this rocks in here?
Daddy, tomorrow I'm auditioning to dance on a TV show.
No, it is not. First the hair, now this.
But all the kids are batting up their hair now, hon.
You're no help.
It's ratting, Daddy. And our First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy, does it.
I don't believe that.
What do you mean you don't believe that? How else would it look that way?
I believe that it is naturally stiff.
What saves Travolta is his dancing. He has a song with Walken called Timeless to Me that's in a lilting, big band style, and it's the only number that isn't edited by a Benihana chef. Walken is a musical pro, and when Travolta joins him in a dance, tentatively but with blooming grace, the performance comes together. As Hairspray becomes more melodramatic, it also becomes more infectious. Michelle Pfeiffer plays Velma, the station manager and mother of the show's blonde diva. She's sublime. It's as if her bitch goddess Catwoman had joined the cast of Dynasty. Velma is repulsed by Tracy and wants her off the air. She's also repulsed by the prospect of whites and Negroes doing increasingly dirty dancing together. That's the cue for all the outcasts, the fatties and the coloreds, to march for civil rights. And for Tracy's Bly the Best Friend, played by the lovely Amanda Bynes, to swoon over Elijah Kelly as a fresh-faced black dancer. Now that she has tasted chocolate, she proclaims, she'll never go back. The desegregated finale, Can't Stop the Beat, is a blow-the-roof-off ensemble dance fest that not even I could resist. But it would have been even more fun if the music weren't so homogenized, if it didn't sound the same as all the other numbers, black and white. Hairspray doesn't just preach color blindness. The world it celebrates with such mindless irony is also, alas, color deaf.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. We'll close with music that was featured in the original 1988 John Waters version of Hairspray. This is the Ray Bryant Combo.
It's Madison time. Hit it. You're looking good. A big strong line.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Now when I say hit it, I want you to go two up and two back, double cross, come out of it with the rifleman. Hit time.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Once, the tale of two kindred spirits making music and finding romance on the bustling streets of Dublin, now playing in select theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Martyrs Without Borders, a talk with Mohammed Hafiz, author of Suicide Bombers in Iraq. He says the war has unleashed a new generation of Muslim militants who care little about national boundaries and are driven by the ideal of defending Muslims whoever and wherever they are. Join us for the next Fresh Air.